This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Amid the President's call for $5.7 billion for wall funding and Congressional Democrats' opposition, the federal government remains partially shut down. President Trump claims there's a crisis at the southern U.S. border, but what effect is the rhetoric and the shutdown itself having on immigrant communities and immigration cases here in Florida? Join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Or you can send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Well, with us in the studio, Melissa Marantes. She's with the Orlando Center for Justice. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
Also joined by Antonio Tovar. He's the Interim General Coordinator with the Farm Worker Association of Florida. Antonio, thank you so much as well.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
And Maritza Reyes is the Associate Professor of Law at the Florida A&M University College of Law. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you and good morning.
Well, I want to start with you, Melissa. The president says there's a crisis. He's focusing on the southern U.S. border. The shutdown, though, is creating its own crisis or a series of crises, I guess. What kind of impact do you see it having here in Florida?
So here in the immigration courts, they're currently closed to any non-detained cases. That means anyone who's waiting for their hearing. While we remain closed, while the shutdown remains happening, these cases are getting further backlogged. There's some information we were able to pull. So Track Immigration says there's 1 million pending cases nationally. And Orlando, they report, has just under 18,000 of those. So for every day that we remain shut, those 18,000 become bigger numbers.
Was there a kind of a backlog before anyway?
Yes, absolutely. There was already a backlog. I think there's a perception that the crisis is only at the border. There are a lot of asylum cases. There are a lot of these cases happening both what we call affirmatively and defensively. Mm-hmm. And so while USCIS, which is another body that takes care of these cases, still continues to process and the courts are closed, we're just going to create a bigger backlog.
From the clients you work with, mm-hmm. how many of them, have any of them come across the southern U.S. border on foot or by car or anything like that? Or do the majority of them come to the United States by other means?
There's a mix. So there's a mix of people who may come either by visas. It could be work visas. It could be tourist visas. It could be fleeing, you know, this fear of persecution mm-hmm. in these other countries. That means a fear of harm. And so many of them may come that way. Others may come through a border. Some may just even walk up to the border and say, you know, help, I need safety. So there's a variety of different ways people arrive.
I'm not sure how much of what we're seeing in news stories kind of represents what's actually happening, but do you get the sense, Melissa Marantes, that just the idea of walking up to the border and saying, help, you know, I need asylum, which is, you know, the thing that you can do, is that likely to dwindle those kind of situations with what's happening right now?
I think it's a little bit of a more complex question. To just share a little bit of my experience, since 2014, I haven't seen one person that hasn't either said, I turned myself over to immigration, whether it was at a border or after crossing or after coming on some sort of visa and saying, I turned myself over to immigration to ask for help if that's what they were searching for and they needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen one person not be stopped by immigration. So I think there's a concern, it seems like, for the enforcement procedures. And I see that the enforcement procedures are working. It's not like, you know, before in history where people would be here for maybe years and never be stopped. So when we look at just the efficiency of some of the things that we're looking at, such as this wall and these sort of things, if we're really in search of efficiency, it's already happening. There's no need to go and spend all this money on something else. The efficiency part is happening. Now the question is, we do have, you know, humanitarian reasons, then let's focus on those. Mm-hmm. How do we make those happen in the way that's most efficient?
Is there a case to be made at some level for more funding for other security measures if it's not actually a physical barrier, other things, whether it's personnel or technology?
Probably a little outside my my experience or background, but I'm
right.
Sure there is. But I just don't see, from my experience, people are getting stopped. They are in immigration proceedings. They are going through the channels. So there's nothing a wall is going to change about that.
Mm-hmm. And what can you tell us about the clients you have as far as where they're from, by and large?
So I think we're not talking about a large section of other countries. Venezuela in our area in Florida tends to be a big country in search of asylum. The conditions in Venezuela right now are horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that we see. Based on other just statistical factors, the number one area of asylum seekers is China. So I think the perception is that the border has the triad of countries, which is the triangle they call Honduras, El Salvador, and
Guatemala,
yes, mm-hmm. Thank you. And they do, and we do have a lot of people from that area. There is a crisis happening there as well within the country,
right?
And those countries. But I think it's a bigger picture. I think I'm glad that we have this opportunity just to share the bigger picture. There are other countries. There are other things happening around the world.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're speaking to Melissa Marantes with the Orlando Center for Justice. Also joining us in the studio, Antonio Tovar, Interim General Coordinator with the Farm Worker Association of Florida, and Professor Maritza Reyes with the Florida A&M University College of Law. Talking about immigration, taking a closer look at the shutdown, the rhetoric around immigration, and what's actually happening here in Florida with people with immigration cases, what's happening with those cases, and some of the policy as well. Antonio, tell us, if you could, what you're seeing in the communities that you represent and talk to, you know, with the rhetoric and the focus on the southern border wall, the president's call for more money for a physical barrier. What kind of impact is that having on the communities that you deal with every day?
Well, something that the community have seen is that there is not a change in the discourse of this administration. This is something that it came from the campaign. And the discourse in the last 2 days, it has not changed what it was promised to the base of this administration. And it was basically to build the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the communities, I think that after the Trump of the current president, there was a lot of fear, and there was also a lot of harassment on some of the children of these migrants that they were bullied at the school, mm-hmm. telling them that when are you going back to your country when they were born in here. So there was a lot of sadness and also a lot of pain in the community because they feel betrayed. This community has helped build this country. And for the Farm Work Association, most of these persons that we represent, they have been in the fields day and night bringing the food to the communities and to the people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So the sense was a sense of betrayal at the beginning and sadness. Many people actually decided to return to their home country. So if we see how was the immigration pattern of Mexicans, for example, there's more people from Mexico returning to Mexico than coming into here. Now, like Melissa was saying, there's other countries that had a growing influx in here, like the case of Central America, but also from Haiti, for example. We have mm-hmm. a big Haitian community. And they are members also of the association. And something that it happens in their case when they announce the end of the TPS.
Right, and there's supposedly a decision pending on that sometime this year, right?
Correct, but before they have any certainty of what was happening, they start to sell their houses and their cars and start to move, for instance, to Canada, to Quebec, where they speak French. So it is a very complex issue, but it was mainly for the community. I think that there was the discourse have not changed. So the sentiments of the people in the community, it is more of the same.
Mm-hmm. In the past, or you know, when you're talking about farm workers who might just be here seasonally to work when there's a crop to be picked, for example. Has there been in the past? Has there been sort of more free flow back and forth, do you see that changing at all?
Yes, agriculture has changed a lot in Florida in the last 40 years, probably even in the 20, we'll say, because we have the imaginary of agriculture being that kind of of operation of seasonal people that is following the crops.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, the main crop or the main industry in Florida, it's ornamentals. So
really?
Nurseries are the main crop that is farmed mm-hmm. and harvested in Florida. So ornamentals, because they grow in nurseries, they are year-round.
Right.
So there's a lot of seasonal workers, people that live in the community year-round,
mm-hmm.
and they don't move. Now, there's still a lot of crops in Florida, oranges and tomatoes, for instance. And in those cases, yes, there's some migration, but we have to point out that Florida is the main recipient of H-2A workers. That's the guest workers.
Mm-hmm.
So they come actually with visas, and they are in here for the season, especially in citrus. Citrus, 99% of the citrus now is harvested by H-2A workers.
Mm-hmm.
So they are here legally. But unfortunately, for the imaginary of many of the supporters of this administration, they still see them as illegals.
Mm.
Or we prefer the term undocumented, because no person is illegal. But that's the discourse that and the public opinion of people that follows this discourse or is in favor of this discourse is how they see them. But they are actually legal workers.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking about immigration, the current national debate around immigration, the situation for immigrants here in Florida, whether or not they have cases pending before immigration court, what this national debate means for them and what the effects of the shutdown are in some of those cases too. You can call us 1-866-338-5252. What do you make of this national debate and what it means for Florida? You can send us a tweet. Your questions and comments were at WMFE on Twitter. Professor Maritza Reyes, I want to bring you into this conversation. What actually has changed as far as policy in the last couple of years? And are you seeing anything that may change in the near future based on what you're hearing sort of at the national level from the White House?
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about policy right now and the changes, so they have been more executive made, right? So we're not looking at Congress acting on immigration. So it's been more President Trump through his executive orders or, you know, through changing procedures. So I think that some of the measures that we have seen implemented include family separation, mandatory detention, this zero tolerance, and denial of entry at the border, right? And so how those are being implemented, you know, executive orders or issuing memos, or in the case, for example, of Attorney General Sessions issuing an opinion, basically saying that women who have been subjected to violence or people who are fleeing from gangs were no longer eligible to apply for asylum. Well, that was overturned, and that's going to, you know, probably make it all the way to the Supreme Court at some point. You know, President Trump is issuing in all kinds of different directives to attack immigration, all, you know, from different angles. And I think that that's what's causing it a fear.
Mm-hmm.
And these are measures to deter. I think that, you know, it may backfire, because what it's going to deter is people trying to, you know, seek help. And I think that something that is also missed in the conversation is that this is not only affecting immigrants, it's also affecting the Latino community, who are seen as the face of immigration. So I have people, for example, who are LPRs or even U.S. citizens who are reporting that they are feeling targeted and being targeted just because they are associated with immigration.
And as Melissa was saying, that's not altogether accurate. When you think about the immigrant population in Florida or in the United States in generally, I mean, it's not necessarily accurate to say this is that a certain kind of person is the face of that or should be the face of that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. So immigration comes from a variety of countries and a variety of areas. And I think that there may be a picture in general, or even leading to what everyone's been talking about, there is a sense that immigration looks one way or is one way or what's going on. And I think the reality gets lost. So, for example, even piggybacking on Maritza Reyes' comment about the new procedures or regulations, the courts are backlogged even further. Part of that issue, and you know, some are reporting that judges have explained this, is that there was something called administrative closure.
Mm-hmm.
So they could take a case and say, oh, you're petitioning from your your spouse, okay, let's go ahead and close this, let it process, let it take the course it needs to take, because you're not the people that we want to have maybe in our immigration court system. Or, oh, you have this other case. And so they could sort of manage their dockets a lot better. And that's been taken away. So, you know, all these little things, I think, you know, there can be a goal in mind. And maybe if I try to, you know, look at both sides, maybe there was a goal in mind with this talk of the wall. Maybe there was a goal of enforcement of trying to minimize the problem. But I don't think that solution is answering the goal. And so I think that's what we need to sort of focus back at or spiral back at. Mm-hmm. If we're trying to be more effective, if we're trying to manage, if we really want to, if there's a concern for those getting through the system, then let's make it possible. Let's give the judges back their authority to do what they need to do. Let's make it possible. Let's focus on that. If there's these many people fleeing at our border, I hear the stories day in, day out. They're horrendous stories of persecution, of harm.
And is this for the folks, like what they're fleeing or what they're actually experiencing at the border if they're in detention or waiting to come across?
What they're fleeing is what I hear. Mm-hmm. Maybe if we were closer to the border, but Florida is a little far away, so I don't always hear what's exactly happening. Mm-hmm. So it's more what they're fleeing. But I do hear these horrendous stories. And when you see that, you can see a different picture of what we need to attack or tackle if we're trying to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm. Going to go to the phones now. We've got Edgar calling in. Edgar, you're on the air. What are you thinking and hearing, thinking about this conversation?
Well, good morning, and thank you guys for having my call, and thank you for taking up this really important conversation. I actually came in from Colombia with my parents when I was 4 to 5 years old, mm-hmm. and we came in as refugees from Colombia. And one of the things that I just want to mention and make sure that everybody understands is just how absolutely immoral it is the way we treat illegal immigrants in this country, how we abuse them when it comes to labor, when it comes to pay, and how mistreated I believe illegal immigrants are, and how I felt when I was here, not just as a refugee, but moving up as a as a Hispanic person. You know, there is, I just think that that's a societal failure that we have, mm-hmm. the way we treat illegal immigrants in this country.
So it sounds...
I really do.
It sounds to me, Edgar, like you're saying there's a kind of a bigger issue here than what the is kind of hitting the headlines as far as the wall at the border, et cetera.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things that I talk about with my parents a lot is the way that the system is set up, immigrants aren't necessarily set up for failure, but illegal immigrants are set up for failure. They don't have a safety net that they can pull from. They do pay taxes. You know, they are not set up for success in this country. And I argue that is akin to slavery or servitude on some level, you know. And I just wanted to mention that. Mm-hmm. And just how absolutely difficult it is for any immigrant in this country to move forward, but, you know, especially the illegal immigrant.
Edgar, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate you weighing in. If I could throw some of what Edgar is saying to you, Maritza Reyes, what about that notion of just kind of the bigger picture of taking a closer look and a hard look at how the country treats folks who are undocumented in the United States? Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that that the public does not understand is that the undocumented are undocumented sometimes because there's limited ways in which an undocumented may become a documented person, right? Mm-hmm. So they have to fit within a certain category, and there are very limited categories into which people can fit. And the reality is that they are here, and they are here because we are employing them and because we need their services and because they're providing something to the American community, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be here. And, when we look at the undocumented as people and put ourselves in their shoes, right, we understand that it's a humanitarian situation. And what would we want to do, you know, how would we want to be treated if we were in their shoes? And mind you, I was talking to my students in my immigration class just yesterday about the story of Jesus. A student brought up the story of Jesus and said, you know, Jesus was in a way an asylum seeker. And would they have, you know, accepted him or would they have separated him from Mary and Joseph? And so when we look at the undocumented people as these illegal aliens, right, pejoratively calling them this and dehumanizing them, we forget that they are human beings. And rather than look at just the immigration aspect of it, it's look at the reasons why they're here and look at what they're doing here. They're really serving the American community. They are picking our vegetables. They are building, you know, the houses that we need and the infrastructure. When people go and drive around and you see construction happening, look at the people who are doing it. A lot of them are immigrants, and some of them are undocumented.
And it's in Florida, especially Texas, too, I guess. If you're up on a roof, that's hot work.
Yes.
Hard work.
Look at all the jobs that, you know, many Americans or lawful permanent residents do not want to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you're going to find the undocumented population.
Is part of what you do, Antonio, is part of what you do to try and kind of paint that picture for folks who maybe aren't familiar with what farm workers do and the kind of role they play in the economy here in Florida and the United States?
Correct. I would like to address something of what your caller was saying about the treatment of workers in this country, because it's true. And also piggybacking on what Marisa was saying, because it is true. A lot of the work that is being done in Florida, not just in terms of agriculture, but also in construction and also services, because there's a lot of people that is working in hotels and golf course and et cetera, that they are doing that kind of work. They are undocumented and undocumented. And they are contributing to the economy of this country. And I think it's a bigger picture, like we were talking about the wall, because like we were saying, there's a backlog in terms of the processing of people that is trying to enter in here, or there are reasons of fear to move over here. Something that we do at the association is also partner with lawyers to try to guide the people that is in the community and see how they can regularize their status. But there is not enough funding to do this process.
Right.
So instead of...
So you're relying on nonprofits and others to kind of pick up the slack there.
Correct. And the investment is needed in terms of immigration. The immigration system is right. It's broken, but it's not broken because we don't have a wall.
Mm.
Because most of the border actually has a wall, and there is a physical barrier too. There is a river in the border. So there is not a lack of barriers. Detentions have dropped in the border, but it's a lack of investment on the legal system to process the petitions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's where I would see that the investment should go.
Just a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to quickly get your thoughts. Marissa, is there a silver lining at all to the kind of debate that we're having right now, the shutdown? If there's anything good to come out of this, what do you think it might be?
Good to come out of the shutdown. Well, I'm hoping that the conversations that we're having, opening up these doors, kind of informing the public, allowing people to have more access to information on the topic, will be the positive that comes out of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I also hope that there's some recognition and finding that the investment in a wall and these sort of things may not be the solutions we're looking for. Just to share a little bit, I know there's some concern about the, you know, this whole conversation is about the southern border.
Mm.
For 2017, they found that there's something called credible fear, where they check if a person actually is afraid of something in their home country, and that's the reason why they're afraid to return. And so in 2017, they did 80,000 of these interviews. And out of those 80,000, they found that 60,000 individuals had a credible fear.
Right.
We're talking about a high percentage of people with a true concern, with a true fear for their life. And I think that sometimes we don't see this picture. So I'm glad that and I hope that that's the positive that comes out of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marissa Marantes is with the Orlando Center for Justice. Thank you so much for joining us, Melissa.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Antonio Tovar. He's the Interim General Coordinator with the Farm Worker Association of Florida. Antonio, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Maritza Reyes is Associate Professor of Law at Florida A&M University College of Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, Governor Ron DeSantis takes steps to tackle Florida's toxic algae in his first week in office. More on that story when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Governor Ron DeSantis has asked the entire governing board of the South Florida Water Management District to resign. That's the state agency which oversees Everglades restoration and manages water resources in Central and South Florida. In a letter thanking the board for their service, the governor said, quote, "It is time for a clean reset of the leadership of the board." The resignation request came yesterday afternoon. Earlier in the day, DeSantis completed a boat tour of Little Hickory Bay, then stopped at Bonita Beach to sign an executive order aimed at solving the problem of toxic algae and restoring the Everglades.
We had Republicans, Democrats, Independents. I think this is something that can unite all Floridians, and so I'm happy to be able to sign this.
The order puts $2.5 billion towards Everglades restoration, empowers two separate task forces on toxic algae, and establishes an office dedicated to sea level rise. Speaking to WGCU, Conservancy of Southwest Florida President Rob Moher says he was pleased with DeSantis' approach.
We really have, I think, multi-sector. It's just not the environmentalists talking. It's the fishermen, it's the realtors, it's the coastal business owners, the chambers of commerce. We're all in this together. And I think you're starting to see that, we have a great expression, never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think this governor is just coming in at the right time and has a coalition, a broad coalition of support, regardless of political party, regardless what sector you're in, private, nonprofit. We all have to pull together in the same direction.
Well, 90.7 environmental reporter Amy Green has been following the latest news and joins us now. Amy, what stands out to you about this plan?
Well, the plan establishes an Office of Environmental Accountability and Transparency, which will focus on science and making sure state actions are aligned with scientific priorities. And it also establishes a chief science officer. And so what you're seeing is this plan puts science right at the center of all of these restoration plans. And this is striking to me because when you are doing the reporting, when you're talking to the environmental groups, when you're talking to the sugar farmers, everyone says the same thing, which is we need to do what the science says. Mm-hmm. But no one agrees on what the science says. And so what DeSantis appears to be doing here is putting science right at the center of his plans and trying to create this science-based way of kind of mitigating all of these arguments. And it's a very obvious step away from the administration of former Governor Rick Scott, who, as you know, said he was not a scientist when addressing issues like climate change. Mm-hmm. The plan also creates the Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection to help prepare for sea level rise. And again, this is another very obvious step away from the Scott administration. And as you know, the former governor reportedly banned words like climate change from state agencies. And it's a step away from President Donald Trump, who pulled out of the Paris Accord on global warming and has been extremely supportive of a Ron DeSantis administration in the state of Florida.
Amy Green, I guess we're learning as Governor DeSantis takes office and gets things underway, kind of how he's going to govern. But some of the details leading up until now have been a little bit scant. So do we know more about this Office of Environmental Accountability and Transparency? Is it under the umbrella of the Department of Environmental Protection, for example?
These are details that we are still awaiting, but we do know some other things that this plan is intended to do. It's a very wide-ranging plan. It establishes a blue-green algae task force and expands the scope of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Harmful Algal Bloom Task Force, which is focused on red tide. It calls for expedited progress on a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee aimed at Everglades restoration. Mm-hmm. It also creates a grant program for septic tank conversion, and it even mentions Georgia's upstream use of the Apalachicola River. And this has terribly impacted Florida's Apalachicola Bay, where there's a very large oystering community there. Mm-hmm. The plan also opposes offshore drilling, which we have seen has been an issue that's developed under the Trump administration. It even opposes hydraulic fracking.
So it sounds like, as you mentioned earlier, there are some differences between what this plan says and what we're seeing from the previous governor, Rick Scott, and even the administration of President Trump.
I mean, this plan really stands in stark contrast to the administration of Governor Rick Scott, who Scott now is one of Florida's senators. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we're seeing here is DeSantis appears to be positioning the environment as a centerpiece of his administration in keeping with his campaign promise. Mm-hmm. He says his $2.5 billion for Everglades restoration represents a $1 billion increase over spending over the past four years, and it's the highest amount of spending on restoration in Florida history. And you'll remember under the Scott administration, environmental programs were deeply cut, especially the budgets of water management districts, which are charged with overseeing water resources. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a big change as far as the DeSantis administration putting the environment, putting our water resources right in the center. And so the question will be, how will the administration follow through?
And one of the other questions, too, I mean, $2.5 billion is a lot of money. Do we know where that money's coming from?
No, we do not. And that's one concern that has been raised about the plan.
Let me ask you then, Amy Green, about reaction to the governor's plan. What are you hearing from some of the main players in the environmental world?
Well, a lot of environmental groups are meeting this week in the Florida Keys for the annual Everglades Coalition Conference. And I'm hearing there that people are excited. The Everglades Foundation released an extremely hopeful statement in response to this DeSantis environmental plan.
And just remind our listeners, if you could, was the Everglades Foundation the one that endorsed Ron DeSantis in the lead up to the election?
It was the Everglades Trust, mm-hmm. Which the groups are closely connected. The Everglades Foundation and the Everglades Trust are both extremely influential organizations. And the Everglades Foundation released this statement that was extremely hopeful about this plan and described DeSantis's inauguration as a new era in Florida's approach to the environment. Mm-hmm. The Sierra Club released a statement that raised some concerns. The group opposes immediate work on this Everglades Agricultural Area Reservoir, which is this reservoir that's been the focus of such controversy south of Lake Okeechobee. The Sierra Club believes that the reservoir, as it's designed currently, says it's poorly designed. The Sierra Club also points out that the DeSantis plan makes no mention of help from the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Affairs in addressing agriculture pollution. And as you know, nutrient pollution from farms and especially sugar farms south of Lake Okeechobee, that has been another focus of a lot of debate over what is triggering these toxic algae blooms. The Sierra Club also mentions the DeSantis plan makes no mention of combating climate change.
Mm-hmm. Although it does talk about establishing the Office of Resiliency, right, which presumably is to talk about combating the effects of climate change, i.e. sea level rise.
That's right. The DeSantis plan talks about combating the effects of climate change, combating sea level rise, but the plan doesn't talk about, you know, curbing emissions, mm-hmm. or curbing greenhouse gas emissions or things like that. The Sierra Club also mentions that the plan should pay more attention to nutrient pollution that's causing red tide. There's a lot in the plan as far as nutrient pollution that is behind blue-green algae in Lake Okeechobee and the canals flowing away from that. But the red tide that just really especially gripped the peninsula last year, the plan talks a little less about that.
Amy Green is 90.7's environmental reporter. Thank you so much for joining us.
You are welcome.
Still to come on Intersection, new music from Michael MacArthur.
Summer's over and you're moving away. Sat out in the cold for too many days. And when the wind blows, June don't know my name. Summer's over. Last day high school, the day we met. No more living by rules, only freedom ahead.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You're listening to a track called We Live and We Die. It's from Michael McArthur's new album, Evergreen, Ever Rain, which comes out on January 25th. It's the first full-length album from the Lakeland-based singer-songwriter. McArthur's been performing and recording for almost 10 years, but he says this album came on the heels of a tough year. He was constantly on the road, on the verge of burning out and creatively stuck.
2017 was sort of probably the most difficult 12 months of my life. And I think everybody, it's all relative to your, you know, perspective situation, but everybody's had a most difficult 12 months, right? So 2017 was mine, and I'd been touring a bunch, and I'd released a bunch of EPs, and I'd been busy. So I decided to take a break, not from writing, but from being on the road and all that stuff. So I wrote about 50 songs or so and kind of filed them away in a three-ring binder.
That's a lot of songs.
It's a lot of songs, yeah. They're not all good, but you know, but I wrote them in, and you know, hundreds of pages of lyrics, and sort of took that binder, drove from Florida to California, and spent 4 days at United on Sunset Boulevard, and made this record.
Mm-hmm. Who was your producer?
This guy named Ryan Freeland. He brilliant producer. He's won 5 Grammys, and he's known for recording Ray LaMontagne and Bonnie Raitt and Alan Toussaint and the Milk Carton Kids and people like that. I've been, you know, pursuing music as a career for almost 10 years now. It was the first major opportunity I've had. But I always loved his work, because what I do is I sit down and think about the records that I love, the way they sound and how they were produced. And then I would look at the liner notes to see who made that record.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw his name come up on a bunch of them. And so I sent him an email with a few homemade demos that I had made. And he wrote back and said, yeah, let's get on the phone and talk. And then fast forward 3 months, we were in the studio. Yeah.
Who are your inspirations then? I mean, when you talk about those records, you think about the records that you go back to time and again, what are they?
Man, I grew up on a lot of singer-songwriters, people who I knew played an instrument and wrote their music. So people like James Taylor and Van Morrison and Bill Withers and, you know, Bruce Springsteen, people like that. Those are my heroes, you know, Johnny Cash. And I still listen to a lot of their stuff to this day. And those are huge shoes to fill. But if I could even just get a small percentage of what they have in terms of what they've accomplished with their art, you know, that would be a success for me.
It sounds like the career path you have, though, involves a lot of travel. Did you get burnt out from all that touring?
I wouldn't say I was burnt out, but I did feel like I was expending a lot of energy and not moving forward. So, like, on the way to, I could have burnt out if I kept going, but I needed to sort of evaluate why I was doing what I was doing, how I was doing it, and my approach to things. So I took a step back. And that was the best thing that I could have done, because now I feel more clear about what I'm doing than I ever have.
Do you perform with a band ever, or is it just solo stuff?
When I'm on the road, it's always solo. Mm-hmm. Only because I'm not at the point yet where I can afford to bring a band on the road. One day I would love to do that. Traveling alone gets old, you know. But so the album comes out on January 25th, and on January 26th, I'm playing an album release concert at the Polk Theater in Lakeland, and that'll be a full band show.
And are you guys rehearsing for that at the moment?
Well, it's interesting because, so I've done a few full band shows at the Polk Theater, one of which I played with the Imperial Symphony, so it was me and the band and 20-piece orchestra behind us, and that was in 2016. And when you're dealing with a bunch of people, it's hard to get everybody together at the same time. For instance, I have two guys coming in from the West Coast to play this show on the 26th, but they're not coming in till the day before the show.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll rehearse as a band the day before and then maybe run through it one time the day of and then just go out there and play it.
Have you performed with them before, though?
In some way or another, I've performed with all the guys before, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is kind of like a reunion concert in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. And we're all pros, so, you know, it won't be perfect, but it'll be exciting because we haven't rehearsed it to death.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to Michael McArthur about his new album, Evergreen, Ever Rain, which will be released later this month. Michael McArthur, you're going to play a track from the album now. Tell us about that track.
This is a song called Warmer Months. And over time, I've realized that there's this hidden message sewn into the seam of every romantic relationship. And it reads, we made this fire. And over time, you get bored and you get busy. Things get tough. It rains. But that message is still there. And with a little effort and a little patience, and with both of you working at it, you can feel that love again.
Summer's over and you're moving away. Sat out in the cold for too many days. And when the wind blows, June don't know my name. Summer's over. Last day high school, the day we met. No more living by rules, only freedom ahead. Swift as a breath, the days they went. Summer's over. Safe travels, my friend. Go on and find a life for you and truly live. And when you disappear in a deep emerald sky, I hope it's my voice you hear. More than I realize. I like to think I'm not one to give up. We drank that drink to the bottom of the cup. If only we held out just long enough, the rains will. If I could do it again, we'd move together and leave this old life in the rearview mirror and never look back to see it disappear and find summer somewhere else. Safe travels, my friend. Go on. Find a life for you and truly live it when you disappear in a deep emerald sky. I hope it's my voice you hear. I love you more than I realize. Come back round the warmer months. We feel on our faces the heat of the sun. We feel in our hearts the warmth of our love. We feel in our hearts the warmth of our love.
That's Michael McArthur with a track called Warmer Months. It's off his new album, Evergreen Ever Rain, which comes out January 25th. So tell us about the next track you're going to play.
So this is a song called Rests Unknown. And when you're growing up, when you're young, everything is larger than life. Your backyard, your bedroom, the street you grew up on. And I can remember being about 5 years old, racing to the field near my house, racing my brother. and he stepped in front of me and I tripped and fell and broke my arm. But I didn't cry. I was probably shock or something. But it was in that moment that I learned that I wasn't invincible, but I met strength and courage for the first time. And so this song is about that. And it's about losing that innocence and realizing that if you look hard enough, you'll find it again right where you left it.
No, I wasn't ready for a life so heavy, for my fears were tall, and I tried to let them go, close my eyes and fall, like tears she is my own. The rest's unknown. Racing toward the sun, hit the ground and broke the bone. The rest's unknown. It's a violent one, you know, so find a boy or a girl and hold your mother close. The rest's unknown.
Michael MacArthur, thank you so much for coming in and performing for us.
Thanks for having me, Matthew.
Michael MacArthur performs at the Polk Theatre in Lakeland on January 26th. More details at wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for this week's show from Emily Lang, Danielle Pryor and Juan Gualda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.